Welcome to the 77th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. All right, now you do the intro. Oh, wow, nice work, Dallas. You were really good at that.
Dallas, high five.
What a born host.
There it is.
Dallas is going to be joining us today because he's here, and we haven't done a show in
forever,
a certain amount of time. Did you think this time maybe that was the end?
No.
No, me neither.
No, not at all. My name is Travis Santel.
Oh, I'm Kalen Egan.
Hi.
And this is Dallas Egan.
Hello, guys.
Yep, there it goes.
Hi,
hello,
I'm
guys.
Dallas.
Yep,
hi.
Great. I'll tell you what. I'm excited to be back. That's how I feel about it. I was excited to get up today. I was excited to come over here and watch Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Where is your? I don't know where your water is.
Oh, go, this is all gone wrong already.
I think go on the other side.
You're gonna watch my attempt at professionalism amidst the maelstrom of child.
Go find your water.
Insanity. That's my plan. Leave this all in.
Oh, I'm leaving it. I think it's over under, like, it's on that side of the couch.
Look, while you're doing this, can I just say something to you about a conversation I had with my mother yesterday?
Absolutely.
I called my mother, as I'm wont to do. I said, "Mother, how are you?" She said, "I'm on my way to the Veg Fest."
The Veg Fest?
She said, quote, "the Veg Fest."
Look under the table.
And,
Oh my God. So did you know that was a real thing, or was that a total surprise?
No, I felt super stoked about it, and I couldn't wait to tell you on the podcast.
All right. You're just going to have to hold on a second while I find this kid's water.
I'll just tell the kids at home, the main reason I wanted to podcast today is so I could tell Kalen that my mom went to the Veg Fest, and I was chastised. I told my girlfriend I was going to call it the Vegetable Festival. I was going to say that my mom said she was going to the Vegetable Festival.
Well, to be cool, and now we know you have to say Veg Fest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it turns out it wasn't a vegetable festival. It was a vegan festival. So,
and she says Vegin?
No, I don't know why she calls it a Veg Fest. But she said...
I guess Veg Fest.
And so
is
we had
weird.
A nice conversation about could I say in all sincerity, could I say on the podcast my mom was going to a vegetable festival? I was told no, that's a lie. I can, however, directly quote her, which was, "I'm going to the Veg Fest," and happy to do so.
All right, well, yep. That accomplished nothing.
Yep. Well, you know, it didn't.
It's been so fucking long.
Stalled so much while you were under a table looking for a child's water bottle. How dare you?
And now I think that people don't even remember what we're talking about. This is a Doc Hollywood reference. Go back and listen to that episode, which was only like two episodes ago or something. We're a disaster.
They know what's up.
I apologize.
I can't apologize. It's just things got busy, and we're doing this thing for free, and we love to do it, and we're excited about all the feedback we get and Twitter mentions.
Well, it's
things,
especially disappointing to our resident in-house artist, who I have decided I love.
Yeah, he's great.
He's awesome. His two or three or whatever. Oh, you have something to say about it? All right, go ahead. Chime in.
Okay, this is going well. This is an inherently auditory medium.
Sing with you?
Which is,
can you do me a favor? Can you sing a song?
That's
not a song. All right, now I don't know what you want, but we have to keep doing the show. All right, so we're going to just keep talking. Today's episode is about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
If you don't follow us on social media, you're missing out on the great image done by
Yeah, that's why
artist.
I brought it up, is
it's
because
really good.
This one is really, really funny and awesome, and I can't wait to see what he does next.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this movie? Let's just do it like a regular show. Like, forget all this other stuff. Like, let's just do a show about
yeah,
this movie.
I'm trying. It's proving challenging, but I'm going to do it. Let me say this. So the last thing I had published was an essay about a show directed by Frank Oz. And so I was thinking a lot about Frank Oz while writing the essay and sort of thinking about his career. I decided I love Frank Oz's career so much. And I'm excited to go back and see this movie, which I've only seen one time.
Wow.
And I don't think when I saw it, I understood it was the same guy who did Star Wars, and various puppeteering that, or does the voices of these things, that directed this movie. I certainly had no sense of that at the time. And so I'm really excited.
So wait, what time, when did you see this?
I had to have seen it right around when it came out.
When you were a kid?
Yeah. No, I saw it when I was a kid. Probably high school, maybe, actually.
I mean, that makes sense. That's
so
cool.
So yeah, I didn't have a sense of who Frank Oz was or his aesthetic or what
well,
he
do
did.
Well, do you even? I mean, right now, sitting here right now as a director, do you have a sense of Frank Oz's aesthetic?
No. Well, kind of from talking to my friend who did his show a little bit about how that working relationship was.
Oh, that's interesting.
I have a sense of him sort of through the eyes of a performer who's been directed by him for a long, long time now. I have that sense. And I have a sense of what I've watched a lot of his interviews recently. Dallas is fucking mean mugging me right now. Dallas is just staring at me.
He's like, when is he going to stop?
Six inches from my face.
This is amazing. What did they say? What's the takeaway?
He's a really funny, really crotchety guy.
Right.
Which sort of makes sense in this. And I love Steve Martin. I love Michael Caine. So I feel like I have a good sense. This is a movie I only saw once, but I have a better memory of it maybe than other movies I've only seen once. Which has to mean something, I guess.
Yeah.
You've seen it a bunch of times.
Many times, yeah. And here's why. I liked it when I saw it. I was big into Steve Martin and stuff. And here's my... This memory may be so wrong, but I think it's right. There was a promotion at the time in like 1990 at like McDonald's or Burger King. And if you paid, you know, $9, which at the time was like a psycho steal, you could pick a VHS to come with your meal.
What?
Yeah, and like they had, I think one, I want to say one was like Adam's Family.
Okay, that makes sense.
And one was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And for some insane reason, like what a weird movie to be part of this particular promotion. But I remember like TV commercials about it and like all this stuff.
That's
and I was
really
like, I got to
go
to the fast food place and get Dirty Rotten Scoundrels because it's such an
weird
awesome
story.
Deal.
Yeah. So
and
you had it.
I owned it.
Oh, great.
And watched it many, many times because of that. And I think it is it feels like it's being heralded appropriately to me, although for the longest time it felt like it was kind of off and under the radar when you talked about
Steve
Martin movies.
I completely agree. It never comes up in Steve Martin conversations. Kaelin's playing the ukulele right now.
Kaelin is? No, Kaelin's that's
doing,
not
no,
me.
Kaelin's doing it. He's trying to serenade you while he's
we'll
lecturing.
It. Play that ukulele one more time. Kind of a visual.
Yeah, it's kind of a visual.
No.
He's
we gotta
sort
keep
of,
recording our show. Can you go play or something?
Eddie Van Halen.
This is me. Yeah,
Eddie Van Halen. This.
Hey, could you go play? Go play.
He is playing. He's just literally playing.
And so I loved it, and always sort of wondered why it wasn't on the.
You're right, man. This thing I think flew under the radar for me. When I list Steve Martin films, there's even a chance I forget to mention
well, but,
this
and
until
I,
like.
And I'm mystified. I'm mystified about why. I mean, I know he didn't write it. He's just an actor in it. But it seems so completely Steve Martin. Like, why do you talk about 90 or 89 or 91 or something.
Not his heyday, but right
fucking
around.
Prime. No, yeah. It's prime, man. I mean, like, this is only a couple of years after. I mean, what do we qualify
I call
as prime?
The Jerk his prime.
Well, okay. Well, that's like his first movie. So
yeah,
that's
but I call that. Like, that's when he's touring stand up. He's like. And then after that, you know, I think.
But the Steve Martin I fell in love with is this era, which is also mixed with bad ones. Like, it's My Blue Heaven, yeah. And there's weird stuff from that era. What? Oh, More Water? I'll get it for you in a second. And so, and what else? And like, and he's also obviously in Little Shop of Horrors, which is Frank Oz, which I was obsessed with as well. So I don't know. All to say, I just totally love it. I could almost, it's a movie that I very oddly could, I know it, I mean, so intimately, I could recite much of the dialogue.
I can't do that. I've only seen it once. But if memory serves, and I'd like to talk about this going into this, because this is now coming up a bunch. Related to this point I'm about to make, did you see... Molly Ringwald's Me Too essay.
Yeah, I read it.
Okay. So that's something worth talking about, I think. And if memory serves, this movie is about two con men trying to get 50 grand or 100 grand or something from a lady. And then Steve Martin has to end up, the bet is he has to sleep with her or something. Is that right?
They both do. Whoever sleeps with her first.
Okay. Should we talk about that?
I mean, the movie is about that. You know, in a sense, like the movie is about the immorality of that, but it's funny, you know, it wants that to be funny.
As memory serves, though, the laser is pointed at them being sort of immoral, and the gag is that they're
it's
immoral
called
guys.
Dirty rotten scoundrels,
right? So
but
I,
they're
I
lovable
but right.
And they're the heroes of the movie.
Do you to me, at least if I'm pitching that to myself, it gets more of a pass than certain other films in that era because the laser is pointed at them being bad people and this is they're doing a bad thing.
Yeah, and the movie is fun because you don't it's tricky because you don't want them to win. You want one of you sort of wind up rooting for one versus the other because it's a combat between these two guys, but you don't, especially because of the way Glenn Headley plays it, and she is a key to the success of the whole film. It's not you aren't rooting for them to dominate her at right, all. It's right. not at all what it's about. They sort of, in some of the joke is like, wow, she's a crazy, it's going to be incredibly hard to get. At first they think it's going to be incredibly easy because she's dumb. She appears to be dumb. Nice performance. Thank you. I'm totally distracted. I can't even have a reasonable conversation about this. But it's a good question. Maybe that's what we talk about on the other side. The thing that I've been thinking about in anticipation of this movie is there's one set piece sequence that is so funny and so weird that I've never quite known what to make of it. And it doesn't have to do with this moment in time socially, as far as what is sensitive and what isn't. But I've never known what's going on with this sequence. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
So there's, without giving it away too much, and I don't want to ruin it for you, there's a scene where Steve Martin has to play Michael Caine's brother.
Well, is this the scene where he has like a mental
yes.
problem? Yeah. Well, the only thing
very unspecified mental
right.
problem.
No, I do remember this, and I remember because the only thing I quoted from this film was Steve Martin peeing himself.
Oh, sure.
This is the part I remember from the film. I'm sure most of the people listening, if they remember a part from the film, I think this is probably the part they remember. I'm guessing because I do. I don't know. I'm just projecting my own brain onto people.
I mean, I'm so psyched to watch it. I hope that we might not watch it together, but I'm psyched to see you on the other side of it at least. Because it's just so fucking gonzo in a movie that doesn't feel that's not the tone of the film, and yet it works. It's just like, where did they come up with this lunatic idea? And it has to be Steve Martin and Frank Oz just being like, how far can we push this?
Yeah. Is this written by any screenwriters of note that we've talked
about?
I wish
I'd looked it up. It may be written by Frank Oz. As I understand it, it's a remake.
Oh, interesting.
Of like a French movie with the same premise or something, okay. You know, like that kind of thing.
Fair.
And they keep talking about remaking it again, weirdly, for a movie that doesn't really have a high profile. But the concept is just so killer and so solid. And these two actors, it's 88, by the way, Steve Martin and Michael Caine are just so amazing together.
Yeah. Michael Caine.
I don't know any of these writers. These
oh, really?
Are some writers that I don't particularly know.
Michael Caine is in one of my favorite films, which I don't think is in our era. Maybe it is, but we've talked about it. Noises Off is one of my favorite plays.
Oh, it's in the 90s. There's no doubt.
And Michael Caine's so good in that.
That's
movie.
In the bag.
Oh, I can't wait for the watch that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this was based on, well, whatever. Who cares?
I will say, coming back after a long absence, not our best introduction, but happy to be here. It's a little unpredictable today.
Yeah.
But listen,
have we
guys,
done a Steve Martin movie?
No.
We've done no Steve Martin movies?
Oh, that's a good point. No, I don't
Is that real?
I think so.
Wow.
It's good. Big day for us then.
All right.
That is
a big day.
I really love Steve Martin. I really, really, really love Steve Martin.
Yeah, and he is... the funny here, here's the one thing I'll say about Steve Martin, which sounds like a negative, and I guess it is, but it doesn't matter, is I've never thought he's a particularly gifted actor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting to see someone who isn't that good an actor kill it in movies because of the dynamism of his personality and style. Like, all you get when you watch Steve Martin in these movies, I mean, The Jerk is an incredible performance, but it's not like he has to do dramatic work.
It's a caricature.
In this movie, he has to do dramatic work, which works because he is a con artist. And so a lot of the drama he has to perform is that this guy can't really do it.
It works, yeah.
It's just fantastic. It's just so good. But I don't want to say he's a bad actor. It's just like I've often noticed you can see kind of the limitations of his talent on that level.
Yeah.
But it has never mattered ever to me.
Oh, same. When you read Born Standing Up and you see, oh, this is a guy with a clear sense of who he is and what his boundaries are, and also the clear sense of wanting to push them at all times, whether it's in comedy or writing or novels.
Well, I wonder, I guess part of it to me, though, I guess the reason I bring it up is I just watched this Larry Sanders, I mean, Gary Shandling doc that they put out, this 4.5-hour Gary Shandling doc. And part of it is about, and I've thought about this with comedic performers in the past, that he really decided he wanted to transition out of being a key creative because it was too stressful and become just an actor. And he was, in this documentary suggests, he was extremely dedicated to being a great actor. He wanted to be a great actor and be thought of that way.
Oh, wow.
And accomplish that. Partly because it was easier, but partly because that's who he is he can't do anything halfway, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes wonder about Steve Martin in the same respect. Is like, when he has full control over a film, it's so amazing. It's so incredible. And even in, including just the ones he writes. I mean, like, I think a lot about Bowfinger, which I'd like to watch again, which Frank Oz also directed, I believe, but which Steve Martin wrote. Oh, you need a diaper change? Can you tell them?
If you're just tuning in to Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, this is how we do podcasts. It's Kalen, Dallas, and Travis sit around and talk about movies.
I would do this every
time. And poopy.
I'm pretty sure we could get used to this.
Think we can get sponsors if we keep this up?
Yeah, right, sure. Great. Diapers. Honest Diapers. Who's that, Jessica Biel? Jessica Alba?
I don't want to talk about it.
Somebody does that. That's like their thing. Don't. He's wearing them right now. I just want to say, I'm about to get wrist deep in some Honest Diapers.
I really wanted to be professional. I had a sincere desire.
Anyway, I don't know what the point is. But in this case, he's not in full control, and yet he is giving a great comedic performance. Whatever, let's go watch it.
Okay, bye.
I can tell you've got a lot to learn about women.
Yes, I'm afraid I am a bit naive when it comes to the weaker sex.
Freddie Benson. And you are?
Lawrence Jameson.
You're married, aren't you?
You can tell.
Listen. We're the weaker sex. Men don't live as long as women. We get more heart attacks, more strokes, more prostate trouble. I say, it's time for a change. I say, let them give us money. Let's live off them for a while. That probably shocks a guy like you, right?
Well, it's rather a revolutionary thought. Do you really think it's possible?
Look what I did in the dining car. She gave me 100 francs. That's like 20 bucks. Do you have any idea what it feels like to take a woman for 20 bucks?
No, I haven't. I'm afraid it's a little out of my class. What?
It's too bad. Could have had a blast on the Riviera.
Hey,
Hey, Kalen.
I was distracted, and you were trying to talk about Molly Ringwald.
Mm-hmm.
What's up?
What?
I don't know. You just said you thought there was something interesting to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, passively. And now having seen this movie, I don't need to talk about it.
All right.
It feels fine. I mean, it just felt relevant.
Maybe we get around to a John Hughes movie or something.
Yeah, we'll keep it in the pocket. What I said to my friend was that, just about that, since we're here, I guess, is that... you know, the society really climbs its way towards a non-rapey place over time, and we have a lot of work to do. And I think it John Hughes did some good work, and it's nice to see other people thinking about the resonance of gender equality.
Boy, oh boy!
So that's all I had to say.
Here, here.
You know, we're moving. We're slowly moving.
Amen. I have one issue. I got worried because we were talking about whether this is a classic.
Yeah.
I guess it is. Most people listening to this show will have seen this movie, don't you think?
I think so.
So, but worth saying anyway, immediately I'm going to start talking about stuff that if you haven't seen the movie, I guess is an issue, is a problem. So if you haven't seen the movie and you intend to have a clean viewing, I guess don't spoilers. You know?
Well, don't listen to our podcast.
Well, yeah, don't listen to it.
This will
be a disaster.
We're
going to
spoil every movie for you. That's what we do.
So, Yeah. Oh, God. Dallas is going to wake up in a second. He's having a nap right now, which is why we're trying to rush through this podcast. But if he joins us, so be it.
I can't take it.
Did you remember the ending of this movie?
No, I didn't, actually.
You did not?
I didn't.
Okay, I'm very glad.
Yeah, I knew there was a thing, but I didn't remember what the thing was.
And
so
you
nice.
Didn't. See it. When did you see it? So the movie, for those who have seen it but don't remember, is Steve Martin and Michael Caine are con artists. Michael Caine is a very wealthy kind of high class con artist, and Steve Martin is a low class. And they run into each other, and Steve Martin realizes who he is, and he insists that he be taken under Michael Caine's wing, or else he'll blow his game with the women that he tends to steal from or con out of their money. And then eventually, rather late in the story, that leads to a bet between the two of them where they want the other gone out of their life, and they decide to make one final bet on a woman to con her out of $50,000, and whoever wins gets to stay in this sort of paradise of a con town in the French Riviera, or and then the other person will have to leave. That's the plot. Mm. And the thing is that in the end, you realize that the woman that they've selected, apparently selected to con, is a con artist. And she has masterminded a scheme to get them both without them realizing. So the reason I bring that up is not really about this Me Too thing, but it is... There's a lot to say about the film, but the first and most, the thing that sort of sticks with me the most or occurs to me the strongest, and I'm very glad that you didn't have that knowledge necessarily running through the entire film, is it's a, I didn't realize this having watched it a million times over and over, but it's a radically different movie if you know that. Mm-hmm. Radically different experience. Mm. And so I wanted you to talk through your experience, and then we could think about how it's a different movie if you watch it a second time.
Yeah, I'm interested by that. When it comes, you immediately start, and not, here's the thing, not in like a Sixth Sense way, but you start replaying all the scenes in your head and going, oh, okay, well, okay. And then the movie tries to sort of bend over backwards to explain that to you. They have Steve Martin say, when did she know? And Michael Caine says, well, she knew from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Right? So the movie's really trying to justify itself to you in that way. Well, before I go into this, watching it with that knowledge in place, does it work to you?
Yeah.
It works totally.
Utterly.
Great. That's great.
But here's my caveat to that. There are things about the movie that don't really work in that sense. In the sense of like, this is not a fucking lockbox perfect narrative of an experience.
I have two things.
Like,
but what I mean is, do all of her motivations in every scene track?
That doesn't really matter because their motivations don't track. The way they behave in any given scene is only for the comic potential of the scene.
We've talked about this before.
It doesn't work.
Here's what I think about this film. I thought it was so fun, and I'm so happy we watched it, and I really liked it.
Yeah.
As just a blanket statement.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, it's great. It's so funny. But we've talked about this on other podcasts, and I really think for the 80s, if the tone of the film matches... the performances and everything sort of tracks, I allow the movie to do what it wants to do in that way. So to me, Steve Martin, his performance justifies a lot of plot shenanigans and holes to me, if that makes sense.
I would extend it beyond his performance. I would say the performances and the tone excuse anything that you could have a complaint about as far as this being some sort of, you know, M. Night Shyamalan-esque, you know, perfectly tight, not that he is, but the perfectly taught narrative plot, you know, it clearly doesn't matter. And what I didn't really realize having watched this as a younger person, is what a masterpiece of tone it is, because it's a very weird American point of view on elegance, but it's trashy elegance without being, you know, slobs versus snobs. Like it's so sort of cruel and knockabout and silly and broad, but it plays with all these sort of beautiful aesthetic conventions, which it doesn't underserve. Like it's really cool in the way that it takes this sort of classic, you know, ugly American sensibility, and uses that to its comic advantage within something that would otherwise be kind of very high society, high class, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad you said the thing at the beginning that you said, because it strikes me that Steve Martin and Frank Oz share a sensibility in ways I didn't understand, I think.
Well, I didn't realize until I looked it up how many films they'd done together.
So, like, Bowfinger.
They did, I mean, Little Shop,
yeah, sure.
Then they did this, then they did House Sitter, which I haven't seen, I saw it when it came out, but it haven't, which is him, Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn.
Oh, of course, right, right.
Which I don't remember anything about.
Yeah, same.
But they did that. And then they did Bowfinger. So, like, clearly they were...
And this is number two of that collaboration? Yeah.
And this is... I mean, it's hard... You know, we can count Little Shop, but obviously that's a whole different thing. And it's not like Steve Martin's the lead or whatever.
Yeah, there's so many scenes you get to by Frank Oz and Steve Martin going, just run with it and see what you get.
Well, and Steve Martin's in Muppet movie, by the way. So, like, I'm sure they were all just hanging out. Like, they knew each other.
They just knew each other, yeah. I mean, to me, and I think you probably agree, one of the first scenes where you really get a sense of that collaboration, that relationship... There's a scene that doesn't cut away. Steve Martin's trying to remember Michael Caine's character's name. And it's probably, what, a minute? Maybe more?
Yeah.
Of just Steve Martin just doing the gag of, like, Jamie. No.
Yeah, one to and no cuts.
It just goes on, and it there's so many waves of laughter, and there's so many like you can't believe it goes on as long as it does. But it's so funny, and it's so clearly just Steve Martin and Frank Oz being like, yeah, run with that. Let's see what we can make of it. And it works. It so works. But
I know.
Unless you have that trust between director and actor, I don't know how you get to something like that.
Do you know how bad I thought of this during that scene? Do you know how bad I miss? Do you know how badly I miss performers, comic performers who just did that? That was like movies were based on that. Like I can't think of. There's no movie I can think of that just allows for that anymore. And what that scene in particular reminded me of is how much we loved when John Candy did it with the mole scene in Uncle Buck.
Same thing.
It's like they just. It's just an incredible performance. It's just somebody being so. Here's a question.
I was listening to a Bill Hader interview, and he was talking about the time he tried to sort of riff with Martin Short and how badly it went because Martin Short's so not to bring up Martin Short again on our podcast, but how good Martin Short was and how quick and fast. And Bill Hader remembers thinking, "Well, I'm not going to ever do that again. I am out of my league, and I've messed up." And it strikes me that a lot of the performers that we're talking about here, Steve Martin, John Candy, Martin Short, to a certain extent, cut their teeth in live performance. A lot of the modern comedians that we work with today don't really, a lot of them have improv backgrounds for a limited amount of time. Then they move straight to TV or film. Mm. And I wonder if those years of just live audience, they know what works without having to try it because they've done it. They know the beats from live performance. It just seems like those guys have the chops.
Well, one of the biggest, this is such a silly thing to bring up right now. And I don't like sounding like a, you know, complainer or kind of grump about
curmudgeon.
Stuff, but
you
like
kind of come across that way.
I know sometimes.
No,
and this is going to be fucking Exhibit A. But there's a actor who I think is basically the comedic equivalent of these guys who fits that same mold, can do that thing, and who I have been tremendously disappointed in the career of, which is Steve Carell. Mm-hmm. And when Steve Carell did 40-Year-Old Virgin. It's like one of these movies, and it's Judd Apatow essentially allowing him to do these incredible performance runs where he'll like sit there. And I remember the scene, and I can't tell you if it's one take, but it barely matters, is where he's trying to describe to the guys around the poker table what it's like to touch a woman's breast. And he winds up saying it's like a bag of sand, which is movie's loaded with hilarious things like that, which is not like the concept is fine, whatever, but it's just a scenario that this guy's comedic gifts are just annihilating. And he has turned his back on being funny. Like, well, I just don't get it. And so anyway, the point being like that, it's not like people, I think improv is the right place to look and stand up to some degree. Although what Steve Martin did when we call it stand up was obviously very different, character based. But I miss it so, so bad. And watching this movie, the most refreshing thing about it, and I guess the era when it was on fire, is that thing.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends who were with Steve Carell at Second City, and it was Colbert. It was Principal Blackman from Strangers with Candy, whose name I forget right now, Greg something. Amy Sedaris, like all these people were around the scene at the same time. And they said that every night, Steve Carell was the funniest. He was the funniest guy every night. And he was so precise, and he could riff, and he could go, and he was so natural and committed to everything that he did. And then he was kind of the last one to crack out of that scene.
Right.
Colbert kind of hit first, and Steve Carell was doing cooking lessons on The Daily Show, basically, for like 3 years, and couldn't crack out. And then
well,
it started
I remember that's the other thing, when 40-Year-Old Virgin hit and he became a thing, I was so excited because his Daily Show stuff, and like I remember specifically he would do these bits called Slimming Down with Steve. His fitness regime or like his diet regime. They were so funny.
Yeah, he's so great. But you know, you smelled that live performance on him. You smelled the stage on him a little bit. And I not that he's gotten away from that or lost anything, but I think there's something about when you transition to the screen. In a little bit, you see this with Steve Martin's later career also. Mm-hmm. There's just less of that vibe. And partly it's an era of performance style, I think, that you're right, that this kind of thing sort of went away. But I think it's sort of prized less, and we sort of gravitated towards screenwriting, and we gravitated towards bits that are specific bits.
Screenwriting and set pieces. I mean, like, I remember
and when... lines, more specifically. Like, mm-hmm. 4DL version starts this trend. We talked about this before. It's like setting up a camera and give me 30 takes of that line.
That's
right?
True.
That becomes a line-based thing, not a moment-based thing. And
that's
I think
true.
That this movie doesn't have... I mean, the lines are fine, but really they're just moments of Steve Martin... And Michael Caine, to a certain extent, understanding that the beat itself is the funny thing, not
Absolutely.
The words that they're saying.
Some of the you're right. So in fact, this is not. It's funny that we don't know the writers of this movie because it doesn't. It's you're right. The lines are fine. Yeah. They're kind of funny, I guess. Like sometimes they're funnier than others. But
how
like,
often are you laughing at Steve Martin's face versus the lines?
All the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's his face is so funny. He's just he's such an unreal person. He's basically he's playing a version of the jerk. I mean, it's kind of that. Which
he's
is
not. He's
he
not.
Is
he's
though.
Not. No,
he
no,
is.
No.
It's this hyper real, hyper emotionally present guy, and you see so much of him. And, which is my point is, it's his stand up character.
Yeah.
It's overly committed, earnest guy, and he's using it to different effect here. He's using it in a con scenario, but even when he's by himself, he's doing moments.
Oh,
like that.
when he's conning her, you're talking
with
about.
His wide open eye,
yeah,
earnest
yeah, yeah.
face.
Okay,
that's
kind of
all
like
over
the jerk.
Jerk.
Yeah, yeah,
and that's
yeah,
all
yeah.
over
that's
his stand-up.
That's true. But that's not the character he's actually playing in the movie.
Yeah, no. But you see those moments so
Absolutely,
much
yeah.
in this film. I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I was saying earlier when I think like when I think of Steve Martin's limitations as a dramatic actor, and sometimes and it's not I was thinking about this. He's not bad. It's not that, and I know I said that also, but like he's. It's not like I'm like, oh, I don't believe him or whatever, but he doesn't have an extraordinary dramatic range. That's all I mean. And so, and he doesn't have an extraordinary comedic range, but that doesn't matter because it's so singular, I guess, is the point.
He's not going for anything really dramatic in this film. I mean, I know you said that in the intro. And
well,
like,
he's going for something.
I get what you're saying.
He's going
like,
for something real-ish. I mean, that's to me, that's the sort of genius of the tone of the movie is that it's cartoony, but it's not... How do you describe this tone? Because you know it's like it splits the difference between something so broad, fairly or whatever that's like, oh, this is just there's no rules and that's the chaos, and being something that's it's not so subtle. It's certainly not subtle.
No, well, it's a tough way. It's a tough thing to put a phrase on, but hyper real sort of comedy or Steve Martin. Hyper-real comedy is the best thing I can come to. And I know I'm not in no way am I knocking Michael Caine. Michael Caine, there's one scene in particular that Michael Caine is so fabulous in and his acting is so good. But to me, Steve Martin sets the tone. And I'm not saying that to denigrate the other actors, but to me, the tone of this movie emanates from Steve Martin's performance. He is, to me, waving the flag about, here's where we are, you guys follow me, I know what I'm doing. And I think the other actors are fantastic. Mm-hmm. But to me, that's how it felt.
To me, yeah, I agree with you, I guess. Once in a while, I wondered if the movie wasn't mean enough. Did you ever feel that? Did you ever wonder that?
I get what you're saying. Yeah, I didn't have that thought, but I totally.
But then I sort of kept second guessing that instinct because I was like, or is that just what now I'm sort of? I think these movies have to be if you're going to do something like this. Like the movie is, it's mean and it's a little bit cruel and dangerous. And sometimes we should talk about a couple of scenes that are so that really push the limit in some mm-hmm. ways. One of which we referred to in the intro, but. It's a tone I miss of like, this is fun and good and you know, it makes you feel good to be watching. And if it were meaner, it would run the risk of alienating other audiences, I guess. You know, so.
Yeah. And also on the tone thing, the movie pretty quickly tells you where it's at pacing wise and content wise. It'll find a thing it thinks is funny and just let it run. And sometimes that feels like it's running too long. There's some montages that I kind of like
that's
checked
right.
out of a little bit, like end of the second act. I just thought, well, this needs to really click.
Well,
on
and
now.
By the way, that's where the plot. That's what I mean when I say like the movie occasionally makes lapses in logic that are glaring. Mm-hmm. Where you know the one of the challenges the movie has is that the main con is that the they both know the other obviously is a con artist because they're in on it and they wind up in a shared story. And so they are forced to kind of perpetuate each other's lie mm-hmm. in order to gain ground.
Which is, by the way, an awesome idea.
It's a great idea. It's also kind of an impossible idea.
Yeah,
like,
but what a good, funny idea.
Yeah. I know. And it makes sense. And I think as I was watching it, I was seeing just the natural pitfalls of that. And mostly they get away with it and it doesn't matter. But there's one scene which is clearly kind of ADR'd in order to make sense. And I have no idea what their original thing was, but what they come up with is really dumb, where Steve Martin needs Michael Caine to leave. And so Michael Caine's butler comes and says, there's someone at the door with a satellite dish. And Michael Caine's like, I didn't order a satellite dish. And he gets up and he goes in there. All of these lines happen off screen. Mm-hmm. So clearly they just put it in there, but it's the problem with something like this, where in order to get her to the next thing, he has to, like, there's no way Michael Caine knows in every fiber of his being that Steve Martin is tricking him.
Yeah.
So why would he let her play out this scenario? But, I mean, the movie just has to do that, you know? It does that back and forth a couple of times. And all those times I was sort of like, oh, well.
Yeah, exactly. You sort of don't care. You're like, well, that's just the way this goes.
Yeah.
And the movie is almost, it's better than what I'm about to say. It's better than this, but it's kind of a repository of bits and set pieces that are character driven. And I know it sounds like I'm slagging it off, but I'm really not. It just knows what it's trying to do and knows what it is and just moves you along. Like, there could be a bigger thing where he distracts him, but the movie's like, let's get to it. Just sort of whatever, get to it. I am curious to know what that came in place of, though, because I totally know what you're talking about. There must have been something else there.
Totally.
That they said, well, that doesn't work. Put something else in. Well, he gets.
Well, even ADR. There's a really, really ridiculous shot, which
Steve Martin did this.
Well, no, that's fine. But where the after, it's hard to explain. It's not worth explaining the actual scene. But after Michael Caine's gone to check on the satellite dish, there's a point of view shot where his hand moves the curtain and he sees that she's run off, and he says, he goes, exactly as I thought.
It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it's ridiculous. I'm glad you brought that up. That shot is the most jarring shot in the entire film. So, Michael, let's just dig into this for a second, because it really bothered me. But I was like, well,
so move dumb. On.
But it's a testament to the film. 30 seconds later, I was like, well, whatever.
Yeah,
who cares?
Yeah, yeah.
But Michael Caine goes in with an obvious thing that's not a real thing. And she goes off and chases Steve Martin. And then it's just POV. It's just Michael Caine POV. It's a camera that looks at the table that's now empty.
Where they were sitting.
Yeah.
Or where she was sitting.
Looks to where Steve Martin had been. Now he's gone. Then it looks back to the table. Just as I thought.
Yeah.
It's the craziest solution to a plot problem.
It's just scotch tape over a problem. Like, who knows what it was.
Yeah.
And who cares.
But great.
I want, oh shit, there was something I was just going to say. What were we talking about before that?
I don't know.
Oh, I know what it was. It was that the movies that this is most resembles, and this is complicated, is, maybe it's not that complicated. It's not a screwball comedy, but it works like a screwball comedy. It kind of works like a Preston Sturges movie, where it never actually really, it keeps threatening to become totally off the wall physical. And even though there are some scenes that do that, it actually doesn't do that. It never goes totally ballistic like a traditional screwball romp would eventually go. It actually maintains its sort of placid tone across the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And it stays extremely pleasant, but it never reaches fever pitch, which I thought was super interesting. And that distinguished it in my mind from what you would call a screwball.
Yeah, well, let's broaden that topic, because this is the other thing I wanted to talk about, is the structure of the film is actually really weird and interesting to me.
Yeah.
So you're right, it never hits that there's no chase sequence, there's no wacky madcap thing through the streets of Zurich or French Riviera. There's no, none of that happens,
and there's no, speaking of noises off, there's no like farcical scenario where they both have to keep up things and it gets all,
there's no Mrs. Doubtfire moment where he's in the restaurant. None of that stuff happens, which structurally you think it would, because they're both living double lives. It seems at some point they'd have to tend to those lives in equal measure. None of that happens.
Yeah.
And in fact, they don't meet the ingenue, third con woman until an hour into the film, halfway through, almost
like 45. Yeah. So it's weirdly, I didn't actually track this, but it felt like where they meet her, the movie wants us to feel is end of the second of five acts. Like, that's where it happens.
Well,
so I didn't look to see if it actually matched.
Well,
that.
I had Kaylin stop the film because it felt like the first act was ending to me, or the midpoint. I couldn't quite tell where we were at because enough breaks had happened. Kaylin stopped the film, and the movie's an hour and 50 minutes. It was 45 minutes in right there, which is an arbitrary.
Well, it's arbitrary. Course. And again, I don't know that anybody bothered to structure it this way, but it's exactly where
your second
two
act
of five went
exactly.
End, and so
it does sort of. You want to talk to your son?
Yeah, I guess I got to go get him. Pause it.
I'm going to give a monologue.
Or just talk. It's okay.
No,
I'm going to get this guy.
Here's what I want to say, you guys, while Kaylin's out of the room. I just want to say that I came over here really wanting to be professional, and I had I told my girlfriend, I said, you know, I hope we still have it, you know. I hope we still have the juice and we remember how to be a professional podcasting team. And she said, well, you'll figure it out. And I said, yeah, we will figure it out. And then immediately when we started rolling, I just felt, who are these jerk amateurs? It's not who we are. So I'm really struggling to get us back on track. So in service of that, I am now going to pause it. Now that I've said that, apology to everyone listening. Oh, never mind. Kaylin's back. Hey, Dallas. Good to see you. Yep. All right. Anyway, what else do you have to say about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels?
How was your nap? It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we finished the movie, and now we're talking about it. Do you have anything you want to say about the movie?
Yes.
What would you like to say?
No, I like.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you heard it here first.
Yeah.
So, by the way, to sort of return to an old topic, and then I want to move on to a new topic, but since I already introduced it, yes, the answer is the movie plays perfectly the second time, if you watch it through again.
Great.
And the joy of it is watching her get one over on them. That's
does
the whole thing.
Does she, as an actress, give any winks or nods?
Well, here's why it works. Her con doesn't really make any sense, but the movie knows that, and the movie plays to that by saying she's having fun. She's great. Just fucking around.
Yeah,
with them.
Great, great, great.
Like, that's the whole joy
she
of it.
She clocks their con immediately. It's like, well, these guys are dummies.
And I'll just play them against the other, and I'll keep milking it with my innocent act. And it totally holds as a logical thing to do if she just thinks this is funny. And the joy of seeing it sort of gets away from any very latent, I must say, misogyny vibes. Because she's funny already, and she's kind of in their story, she's essentially an innocent non-character. But when you know that she's not, it's great.
Yeah.
It's so fun and funny to watch them bounce off each other when she has the upper hand. Like, that's sort of why a second viewing still works, because wonderful. They suddenly become, they almost aren't the protagonists, you know, they're petty. And sort of silly. And it's actually a little bit less of an... It actually, maybe that's my feeling about, is this mean enough? Because knowing that she's always got one over on him and she's always going to win.
Yeah.
It's cool to watch that. I mean, they never come close to finding out until she wants them to. And so there's a... It seems like that would suck out the tension, but I don't think it does. It just makes it funny.
Yeah, that's great. No, I would. This is a movie I would watch again just to see it from that angle. I think that'd be so fun. Yeah,
it's just pleasant. You know, it's like those movies, like the other movies we watched that are like this, you know, which some people call a like hangout movie or whatever, which is like Big Lebowski kind of works this way. Dazed and Confused, often people talk about this way. It's like you just like visiting them in a funny way. And even though they're mean, they're kind of nice mean. Like they aren't really cruel. And every time one thinks that like she plays one against the other with them thinking the other is more cruel than they are, which is sort of fun. But you never, especially having seen it once, you never think, oh, these are bad people. Really.
You know what? Yes. There's a moment where in the ending of the film, as we're barreling towards the conclusion, Michael Caine gets a call. Michael Caine, who has been sort of charmed by the Jackal and thinks, oh, you're a really good person. And this is the scene I'm talking about where he gives a great performance, where he like realizes her inherent goodness and really buys it, and really is like, I can't take this woman's money, she's too good.
So watching, can I interrupt you very briefly? So the situation basically is he thinks Steve Martin has totally double-crossed her, stolen all her money, slept with
her.
Well,
wait, this is the part I want to talk about.
Okay.
Sorry. So we get the call, he gets the call that Steve Martin has stolen her money. And it's a testament to the film that as a viewer, I went, that doesn't sound right. That's not the character I sort of know. I know he's a con man. I know he's a thief. He's not the kind of guy who would seduce her and take her money. And I remember that being so jarring to me just now watching it that it really struck me, oh, this movie's doing a good job because I don't think he's a bad guy. I knew in that moment, my gut told me I didn't think he was a bad guy.
But did you think that rings the wrong bell, but... It's the movie is saying that's what happened, so that's what happened.
Like, no, it struck me as wait, something's wrong.
So is that where you started to clock that? Oh, she's got him.
Yeah.
So,
well, I didn't clock it all the way as to what was going on, but I knew something about that story was not true, because Steve Martin is not the kind of guy who would do that.
So what I was going to ask is when Michael Caine gives her money, did you think she's got him?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. At that point, I'm like, I'm like, I know what's
But that's
going
still
on.
Part of the performance that you thought was really great by yeah. him, right?
Oh, well, yeah, but I didn't care in that scene. I didn't think that scene was good.
Got it.
I'm just referring to the one scene outside the hotel where Michael Caine realizes he's dealing with an actual genuinely good person.
Oh, I see.
And his eyes
see,
well up with tears, and he just says, oh, I didn't know people like you existed. And you know that's the
Got it.
It's not his performance of the character, the con man, whatever, you know what I'm saying. It's not the layered performance, it's his actual... That character's real thought.
Well, the other brilliant, by the way, just while we're talking about Michael Caine real quick, the brilliant thing about him, and that, again, that I didn't realize when I was younger, is that he, when I was young, I thought this guy is just what he presents as, which is he's an elegant, you know, high class, high society British guy who has this, who you know, he does this because he's that cultured. What I now know is that what the reason it's brilliant to cast Michael Caine is that he's a cockney trash, you know, low class actor,
which the movie lets you in on.
Yeah, which is rad.
There's a moment where you realize he was in the Navy Reserve for a little while, which is not something a high class person would ever be a part of. And the movie tips it. I mean, it's in service of a dumb plot point. Who cares? But it, as a character beat, it's really awesome. I think that it's like, oh, by the way, this guy that you think is just a rich baron's son who's gone around, you know, milking women, other money,
women.
Well, mulcting is the word I want to use, which is the actual word I just learned, but I thought it'd be weird to say it on the podcast.
It is
mulcting. Look it up. It means taking someone out of their money. Like,
what?
Yeah,
mulcting. Are you kidding me?
I'm serious.
That's amazing.
And then I switched to milking because I didn't want this conversation to happen. So here we are. But yeah, it's a great character beat. It's a great character beat that you go, oh, this is a low-class guy who's made something of himself by his charm. And he's also aging out of it.
Yeah.
Two things. I have two things I want to say. One, does it seem to you that every time Michael Caine smiles, he's in a lot of pain? It's weird to watch him smile, I realized.
He's in pain?
Yes. It looks like it hurts him to smile. And it really, and I'm being serious, I'm not being snarky. Every time Michael Caine smiled in this movie, it took me out of the film because I thought, that is not something that's natural to this guy.
Well, that may be. I did not think that he looked like he was in pain. I mean, the smile is part of what makes him seem like it's not that he could be dangerous, although knowing that in his history, you know, that he comes from like Get Carter or something, he's like a bruiser, like he can kill people. Mm-hmm. But that just, it brings this kind of low level of menace or danger to what he's doing. And
danger. I just felt like, oh, he's had dental work done and it hurts him to smile. Like I felt
you
like
think
physical
he physically
pain.
Gets like gum pain from smiling.
It looks like something in his cheeks hurt when he curls them upwards towards his eyes. It really seems like something has gone wrong
like,
in his
don't
face.
Make me smile.
Yeah. I'm not going to do a second. I'm not going to do a smile.
You're thinking about smiling
in
his Dallas cheeks?
Dallas is now smiling.
Yeah, can you smile?
There you go.
Nice.
You got a smile. The other thing I want to say.
Oh, it hurt. Ouch. Oh, that hurt.
Oh,
it
smiling hurts. Are you Michael Caine?
Ow.
He just hit himself in the face with a tennis
careful,
ball.
Man.
The other thing I want to say is, can we talk about, so the movie ends naturally and beautifully and whatever, the way it should end, I suppose. But was there plans for a sequel for this film?
Oh, I don't know. Not that I know of.
It ends with the sense that you could easily do a sequel. And in modern era, if this movie came out in 2018, you
and
think,
was a
well,
hit. They'd certainly
they set themselves up for a sequel.
Yeah, this was a time where they didn't think about sequels.
So it's just the way they wanted to end it.
There's no, I mean, think about that. Like, think about how few sequels there are to comedy movies from this era that aren't, like that are essentially, specifically comedic star driven.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Martin never made a sequel to any of his movies.
Yeah, besides Eddie Murphy, who do we have?
Yeah, exactly. Besides Eddie Murphy, that's interesting. Yeah. But those are action-y. They made action sequels.
Comedies.
They made lots of diehards. Mom's not home right now.
Oh, he's so sad.
She's not here. She'll be home in a couple hours.
We've been doing a little bit of high-fiving during the podcast. Should we do that?
John Candy's not in any sequels.
Yep.
It just didn't happen.
Even Home Ghost Alone?
Well, sure.
There you go.
That's not a star. That's a kid. I mean, he's a star, I guess, but he's not a comedy star.
Yeah.
Anyway, I also wanted to mention that we know that they did like a Broadway musical based on this. I have no idea if that's good, but it's a weird thing that this particular pocket of nostalgia, being 80s sort of adult PG comedies, Groundhog Day, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels,
Doc Hollywood.
And And they keep talking about like defending your life becoming a Broadway musical. Yeah. So anyway, it's a very odd way to deal with the nostalgia on something you can't really reboot, you know, or do
it's
again.
It's just a good idea though. Like this is a but good idea for a film.
It's and a good I get idea why for a story. It's a great idea for a story. This movie doesn't get made today.
No,
they
no,
can't
no.
remake this movie. No. They can't remake Groundhog Day. You can't do any of that stuff. That it's too sweet in sensibility. And I don't necessarily I don't mean like wussy. It's just like this is a different. You know, Bill Murray talks about this sometimes. You know, when they were asking kind of how come he doesn't do, like, before he became Wes Anderson's guy.
Mm-hmm.
And people were sort of like, how come they, like, Bill Murray isn't in that many movies anymore? And he was like, well, they don't make my movies anymore. They don't make my kind of movie anymore, and that's why. And that's why, and he's talking about, even when we watched Kingpin, that's not, like, he's amazing in it, but that's not really what he means. And I think this tone, mm-hmm. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Groundhog Day, even like Man Who Knew Too Little, like that's the tone Bill Murray's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is out of favor. They just don't do it anymore. Yeah. Those movies don't exist.
Yeah.
And how interesting.
Oh, watch that drink you're about Careful. To hit over there, buddy.
He's swinging a tennis racket.
Yeah. Well, it's a racquetball racket, to be fair.
So let's just say, I just want to talk about the Ruprecht scene.
Yeah.
What do you
so
make of it?
This is the scene. So to
you,
set
can
the
you
stage,
describe it? Yeah.
Yeah. So this is one of the first times you understand what's going on with the movie a little bit, which is a counterintuitive thing to say. So the gimmick is that Michael Caine is going to get rid of Steve Martin's character by taking him under his wing and showing him things and then not paying him. And then
by just making him hate the apparent life that
he's
being groomed for.
Which is really, by the way, a crazy plot
point.
It
makes no
sense.
And
it doesn't make sense. So whatever. But what it gets you is for about 8 minutes or 10 minutes or something, Michael Caine is teaching Steve Martin how to be a suave con man, which immediately goes away. It's just played for laughs because then he makes him act as his mentally challenged in some unspecified way younger brother. And the game is Michael Caine will seduce these women, get their money, promise to marry them, and say, oh, by the way, my younger brother will have to come with us to America. He goes wherever I go. And then Steve Martin drives them away with his madcap antics.
Now, this bugged me vaguely. How this results in him taking their money, I have no idea. And the movie does not bother
to
share that. They you just know that on the other end of this weird idea, they make money. It does not hold water.
Well, here's the thing. This is when the movie told me what it was, I think, is that for this whole sequence, when he says, okay, come on board, I'll teach you what I know, that whole training sequence where it, you know, it's kind of funny, where Steve Martin's trying to be a suave debonair, it's a little over the top, even for this film. And then there's a whole sequence of him playing this mentally challenged younger brother. You can lift that whole sequence, that whole section out of the movie, and the plot changes zero.
Yeah.
There's no need for that sequence in terms of their relationship, in terms of the plot, in terms of anything that happens in the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So then when I was watching that and it ends and you realize nothing's changed, I thought, oh, this movie's just going to hang out and take time to do funny gags. It thinks are funny.
But then it introduces a plot.
Yes. But at about an hour in. So
yeah. But that's weird. That's actually interesting. So if we're talking about this sort of, if let's just pretend that it does hold up to a five act structure, the second act is a sort of fun and games that doesn't engage the actual plot story, which is allows them to do this very bizarre set piece, bit of business.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't even know.
I mean, is it as weird as I'm making it sound?
No, it's weird, man. It's weird because A, it goes on so long. It's weird because I legitimately, on a fundamental level, don't understand what Steve Martin's doing. I don't get it. I get that he's trying to drive the women away, but I don't understand what the idea is of what he's doing.
Yes. The con makes no sense.
Yeah.
And so it's just...
Well, the con makes no sense, and also Steve Martin's interpretation of the con doesn't make sense.
Well, what is... But here's where I kept getting stuck, and it's even earlier than that, which is, whose idea was this?
Michael Caine.
No. I mean, in the filmmaking sense.
Oh, God.
Like, who came up with this idea and how? Given that it has no actual functional purpose.
I bet you it's a vestige of an... So there's two... There's a set of screenwriters, and there's a third screenwriter who came in separate. Based on the credits. So I bet you it's a vestige of a draft of the script where this made more sense. And they thought... Oh,
you think so?
I do. I think this. I think that there was an older draft where this maybe had some bearing or some relevance to the plot. And they had them working together for longer, maybe, that they were going to try to be a con team. I don't know.
I don't know about that, man. I have a very different... I don't have a theory, but I would think something very different. I mean, I would
think
that this came organically from, we have to do a funny thing where they, you know, bond or what. Like, I'm sure there was a plot point where, you know, he has to try to turn him away.
But they don't bond over this.
Well, anti-bond, I mean, because they have to get Steve Martin to the point where he's like, I'm not doing this anymore. And so then they're like, well, you know, Blue Sky, you know, what can we make up?
Right. But that's also where the sequence starts. The certain sequence basically starts with him going away and then coming back. And the sequence ends with him going away and coming back.
Yeah.
So you don't have to do that. There's no structural need for it, which is why I think it has to have existed on a...
It can't be a plot vestige. This is a character, because it's so character-y.
But nothing happens character.
Nobody would even... I don't know what it is either, but nobody... in their right mind would think of this
as an idea
for just anybody. Like, you have to have Steve Martin to come up with this idea. Yeah. Like, however that happened, it's because what the thing is, so he's, we keep sort of beating around the bush.
I don't know how to talk about it. I'm so befuddled by this beat.
He's a series of, a mess of inexplicable mental deficiencies, which is he's childish. He walks like a monkey. He throws tantrums.
Bangs pots. Stabs himself in the eye.
He seems to be sexually aggressive. Uh-huh. He will self-harm. So he's also locked in a room. It's just like all sorts of... He has ridiculous hair. Like, it's just a million different
but
weird
speaks
things.
Properly.
Can say words.
Like
he's not. He's not.
He's not. It's not infantilized.
Like, yeah, no.
He
clearly doesn't have like... Like, there's no... Nobody could diagnose what he
No,
is.
It's not. Yeah, which
and
maybe
the movie knows that.
Yeah, like which
the,
maybe that, is part of the joke that
well,
like
it makes it a little bit. It's not offensive because he's not specifically doing any single mentally handicapped thing.
Yeah,
but what he's doing is who knows.
Yeah, it's very.
So is it? So my question
and
is,
and it goes on for a long time.
It is the thing that I remembered most vividly from past viewings. I mean, because it's funny and Steve Martin is going crazy in the way that you're like, oh, Steve Martin goes crazy. Like, that's kind of what he does. This scene is him going crazy. But is it offensive?
I don't know who it would be offensive to.
Uh-huh.
Which is my main thing. Like, I'm not quite clear I understand who the movie would be attacking or, like, offending.
Yeah. I don't know either.
I mean, I don't know anyone in the world who walks like a monkey, says very erudite, you know, sentences. Dallas is doing a monkey impression. Except for your son. Say, I'm sorry, you're right. Dallas, this is offensive to Dallas. You guys should see the arm movements happening right here because...
Sort of chicken.
Yeah, you're doing a chicken arms for the monkey.
Perfect.
Oh.
Dallas did. He watched the sequence. He seemed to enjoy it.
Yeah.
Now, you want me to do a chicken? Mm-hmm. Are you confused? I feel like one of the...
Oh,
confused
we're professionals.
My own idea of what a chicken sounds like.
That's a monkey.
That's a monkey.
Can you do a lion since we're fucking here? That's a lion. That's a lion.
You can do it.
Right, he's being very scared. Great.
Anyway, so no, you're right. I mean, what I feel so sensitive these days.
Yeah, I'm my.
I try to understand what sensitivity is.
I'm actually kind of surprised how. Listen, what do I know? But I'm surprised how inoffensive I found the film. I was actually kind of trepidatious going into the film about, you know, two guys trying to sleep with a woman, which is kind of what I remembered the plot being.
It's also, yeah, we got that wrong. Let's be clear. That's actually not really the plot. That's a late addition, and it's not two guys trying to sleep with her. It's that, and this is actually an interesting thing that we both noted, is Steve Martin says the bet is her. I'll sleep with her first. And Michael Caine says, no. I'll take your bet, but I'm not going to sleep with her. I just bet you fail.
Yeah.
And so it's like, it's actually kind of cool the way.
Yeah, it's either Michael Caine's character, which I think is true, has turned and has shown affection for her and doesn't really want to be a part of this, but is stuck in the bet with this guy, or the screenwriter said, Michael Caine's way too old, this is gross.
Well, and it's a beautiful way to set up what we think will be, I mean, even though it doesn't exactly work, based on how you responded, which I think is correct, it sets up that Steve Martin is more cruel than him. And it sort of sets you up for that idea that Steve Martin really did sleep with her, take all her money and run.
Yeah.
Because he's willing to do it. He wants to do it. And Michael Caine at this point has sort of found certain morality, and he's like, I think she's so pure and good that she won't fall for it with you. Yeah. That's the bet.
I'm betting on my understanding of human nature, right. Which is ironically very funny when you look back, because he misread everything. No, but I was looking for things that I felt like might be more offensive, but it's so madcap, and so the same way the jerk isn't necessarily offensive. I don't know what his deal is in the jerk. He's just a wacky guy.
Oh man, something just occurred to me, by the way. Speaking of Broadway, do you think the Broadway musical has the Ruprecht sequence?
No.
You think they just cut it?
I think it can, because it's so modular.
But it's so memorable. So if you're going to do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels,
that's a good point.
Can you get away with just
losing
it? Oh, that's
interesting. I mean, it is the one thing I remembered about the movie.
Yeah, you said so.
Yeah.
Is there a song associated with this character? I gotta fucking know. Like, if they just cut it because they like workshopped it and were like, ooh,
it's too weird.
Can't do it. And nobody can do it if you're not Steve Martin. I need to know this.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my favorite, whatever, I could talk about the jerk for days and days and days, but I just feel like this combination he does of wide-eyed idiocy and earnestness is so particular to him. Right. That I find myself just in love with it, and I find it, because it's not specifically aping anything, I find myself being unoffended by it. Again, what the fuck do I know? If someone's offended, that's their right, I suppose. But to me, I found so little to be offended by in this film. It just felt so madcap, tonally consistent, and with Steve Martin's earnestness, you just think, well, this is kind of a dumb guy who's not good at what he does, and that makes it okay.
So let me ask you, as a sort of way to potentially wrap this up, if that's about where we're at.
Well, I have about 10 more minutes of Dallas making noises. I think we can probably fit in.
Yeah, we'll go out that way.
Okay, great.
But before that, I'm not sure where I stand. I'm not sure where the world stands on this movie, whether it's a classic or not, whether it's considered
I'm surprised how little
movie.
People talk about
well,
it.
Well, but here's my... So this is my question. If that's the case, which I think it is, this isn't The Jerk. This isn't, you know, that class of movie. You are not going to go find this at a revival screening, probably. But why?
Yeah, that's a great question. I honestly don't know. Mm-hmm. I think it's structure. I think if this was, here's maybe a weird idea. If this movie was 20 minutes shorter, I bet you would be more of a classic. It feels like it's something that's tonally doing a thing that doesn't happen anymore, which is just meandering fun and games.
I think I just kind of answered my question, which is that this isn't a movie that was made for kids. And really, and a lot of the movies that get revived now or that get sort of celebrated appeal to a different generation. This movie is for grown-ups, even though it's not like ultra adult and it's still like broad and silly. There was a time when silly was for adults also, you know, and I think Steve Martin is in some ways that typifies that.
Yeah, he is. Well, that's true. Steve Martin is silly for adults. That's his thing.
Right.
And especially his first few films. I think are that.
Well, right. Jerk is rated R. I mean, that's, you know, that 9 second Lonely Guy's rated R. Like, that's true. That's what that is. And so that doesn't really play the same. Jerk is a stone cold classic, but it's way wackier than this.
Stone cold classic.
It is. I mean, everybody knows The Jerk, but but this movie.
Yeah, it fell off my radar, but I like it.
It just falls between the cracks of what we remember.
I think so. And also Michael Caine is a guy that. He's hard to pigeonhole or pin down in this world because...
Well, how crazy is it, by the way? I'm sorry to interrupt
No,
you,
I was kind of stumbling through it anyway.
Well, just how crazy is it that in this movie he plays the older Twilight years guy and 30 years later he's still that guy.
Yeah, that's what I kept running into is that...
Like he could actually basically play this part right now.
Yeah.
Right now.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, because they took all the sex out of it. They'd have to take away the part of him kissing the woman, but...
not really.
I think so. If Michael Caine today, on the dance floor?
Oh, I guess.
You'd have to lose that. Everything else can stay.
Yeah.
Everything else can stay.
Yeah.
It was weird to see a younger Michael Caine in a certain way, but also how little he's changed. And also, you think about his career, how many different pockets of career he's occupied.
Yeah.
Over the years. And Steve Martin, at least, is somewhat consistent in his artistry, if nothing else, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I always find myself searching for the other person. When I think about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I go, Steve Martin and oh yeah, it's Michael Caine. Like, that's how I think about it.
Oh, wow, interesting.
I don't lead with Michael Caine in my brain. It's always like I have to take a second to figure it out, which tells me something, that it's not occupying the right spot in my brain for whatever reason.
Well, anyway, I long for days, and not in a purely nostalgic way, but in a movies I like way, I wish that movies like this were around.
Yeah, I loved it. I had a great time. Late second act, a little long.
Mm-hmm.
A little meandery, mm-hmm. but other than that, I feel like it was a really enjoyable afternoon.
It's so enjoyable. Afternoon. It's an enjoyable. Watch this in the afternoon,
yeah,
folks.
Don't watch it before 9 a.m. or after 8 p.m.
Yeah, it's the perfect, and this is the kind of movie that would be on TV as the, like, you know, 3 o'clock Sunday movie or whatever. Perfect.
Let me ask you a serious question, Kalen.
Yeah.
Do you have the bag of films we draw from?
I mean, I don't know where it is.
Yeah, let me hold that microphone for you.
But I can look.
Okay. I got two microphones now, you guys. I got double mics. Kalen's, I'm going to hold this up to Kalen's mouth while he draws a movie for next week. I don't know, but why not? Because I believe...
Well, the last one was... Evan. Time was our,
yeah, drew it last time.
All right.
Here we go. Thanks for joining us, you guys. We're professionals.
In 3 months on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Or whatever. We will be watching.
Or whatever. What?
Read it, Dallas.
Dallas loves this movie.
You love that movie. All right. That's
okay.
What we're gonna
I didn't understand. Can you clarify?
No.
Well, wait, Dallas. Can you give me the plot? I'm gonna guess what it is.
What's that movie about?
What's
can
you
the please plot?
Tell Travis. No, tell me.
Tell him with your mouth in the microphone.
Is it? Wait. Is it The Breakfast Club?
I'm gonna whisper to Dallas. Don't listen.
Okay. That didn't work at all.
He whispered, "It's The Usual Suspects."
Oh, that's a big film. It's our first Kevin Spacey post
disaster.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Next week on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Enjoy us talking about.
It's gonna be tough to talk about. And Bryan Singer.
Oh man.
This is the nexus of nightmare.
Join us,
Dallas. Tell them goodbye.
Bye.
We'll be right back.